In April, Judge Ramos ruled that the Texas voter ID law was intentionally designed to discriminate against minorities. Almost simultaneously, a panel of federal judges in San Antonio decreed that three of the state's 36 U.S. congressional districts were illegally drawn to disempower minorities. Evan Smith, a co-founder of the Texas Tribune, has closely followed 13 legislative sessions. He took note of the attack on sanctuary cities, the persistent unwillingness to adequately fund public education or to expand Medicaid in a state with the most uninsured citizens in the country, and the $800 million of state funds allocated to expand border security. White people are scared of change, believing that what they have is being taken away from them by people they consider unworthy, he told me. But all they're doing is poking a bear with a stick. In 2004, the Anglo population in Texas became a minority. The reality is, it's all over for the Anglos. The most contentious item on Dan Patrick's list of priorities for the 2017 session was the bathroom bill, SB 6, which would bar transgender people in public schools and government buildings from using restroom or locker room facilities that do not correspond to the sex listed on their birth certificates. It also overturns any local anti-discrimination ordinances that permit transgender citizens to choose which bathroom to use. In 2016, a similar bill was signed into law in North Carolina. In response, musicians such as Bruce Springsteen and Pearl Jam canceled concerts, and sporting associations, including the NBA and the NCAA, dropped plans to hold events there. Governor Pat McCrory, who supported the law, lost his bid for re-election, in part because of the national outcry. Patrick contends that his bill will have no economic effect on Texas and that the only people opposed to it are the secular left and the press. They don't want prayer in public schools. They're not pro-life. They see nothing wrong with boys and girls showering together in the 10th grade or a man being in a woman's bathroom, the lieutenant governor said at a prayer rally on the Capitol steps. Attorney General Ken Paxton, who is under indictment for securities fraud, added, "This is a spiritual war." The bathroom bill arose after the superintendent of schools in Fort Worth, following federal guidelines at the time, announced in 2016 that transgender students would be allowed to use the restroom or locker room that corresponded to their gender identity. He additionally suggested that teachers and administrators refer to students as scholars rather than boys and girls. At the prayer rally, Patrick called for the superintendent's resignation, suggesting that these sorts of policies would be the end of public education and would ignite a mass revolt on the part of parents. "I believe it is the biggest issue facing families and schools in America since prayer was taken out of public school," Patrick concluded. The business community in Texas went a little berserk over SB 6 and produced a report suggesting that passage could cost the state up to $8.5 billion, a figure discredited by PolitiFact. The Super Bowl was held in Houston a month after the legislature opened for business, and in response to the bathroom bill, the National Football League intimated that were SB 6 to pass, the championship might not visit Texas again. Governor Abbott, who had been keeping his head down, told the NFL to mind its own business. Bathrooms had been an issue in the state before. At a Willie Nelson concert in Austin in the 1980s, I was in the men's room when a dozen desperate women barged in and laid siege to the stalls. It was actually a rather high-spirited interlude. It happened again on several occasions, until 1993 when Ann Richards was governor. She signed the Potty Parity Bill, which mandated that new sports and entertainment facilities place two toilets in the women's restrooms for every one in the men's. The bathroom bill was not unique to Texas. A dozen other states had similar bills pending, but it embodied the meanness and intolerance that people tend to associate with Texas. The bill was being sold as a way to protect women against sexual predators who might pose as transgender, a problem that scarcely exists. Laws already on the books protect women from being accosted or spied upon. The sponsors of the bill claim that it was not meant to discriminate against transgender Texans, although the law would do just that. The only remedy for trans people would be to change their birth certificate, a costly and time-consuming procedure. The bill proposed fining schools or state agencies up to $10,500 per day for violations. How are they going to enforce it? Chuy Hinojosa asked me. Would a woman have to raise her dress? There was grumbling about the need to hire pecker checkers. We've talked about the bathroom bill at my regular Monday breakfast, which consists of Steve Harrigan, historian H.W. Bill Brands, and Gregory Curtis, the former editor of Texas Monthly. It seems inevitable that bathrooms of the future, at least in Texas, will devolve into unisex stalls, the way they already are in some restaurants. I said that I noticed a new bathroom in the Austin airport. The sign said, "All genders." Greg observed that would spell the end of urinals. We were all silent for a bit. That would be a loss. Steve later reported a sign on a restroom door at an Austin restaurant that said, "Whatever, just wash your hands." On March 2, 2017, I returned to the Capitol to have lunch with the Speaker of the House, Joe Strauss, a laconic Republican from San Antonio. It was the 181st anniversary of the day Texas declared its independence from Mexico, and the beginning of the High Holy Days among Texas historians, climaxing on March 6th, the date of the fall of the Alamo. The Capitol Rotunda was filled with schoolchildren wearing coonskin hats and gingham dresses with frontier bonnets, getting ready to perform Marty Robbins' song, Ballad of the Alamo. Kids from the Texas School for the Deaf were there to sign as the other children sang. Four retirees, representing Buffalo Soldiers, the black cavalrymen who made their mark in the Indian Wars, were getting ready to present the colors. A tall man wearing a top hat paced about, rehearsing Travis's letter from the Alamo. Meanwhile, on the floor of the House, resolutions were being offered to honor the sacrifice of the heroes of the Alamo and to commend notable citizens. A member advocated for the breakfast taco becoming the official state breakfast item. I met Strauss in his office. There was a bust of Sam Houston on the speaker's desk. "You know, it's also his birthday," Strauss said. He then switched on the closed-circuit television to watch a moment of the press conference for the Texas Freedom Caucus, a newly hatched group of a dozen cultural conservatives led by Matt Schaefer, a state representative from Tyler in East Texas. They modeled themselves on a similar body of House Republicans in Washington. They had formed in part because the term Tea Party, in Texas at least, had lost its meaning, since nearly every Republican in the legislature claimed to be unimpeachably conservative. The declared mission of the group was to amplify the voice of liberty-minded grassroots Texans who want bold action to protect life, strengthen families, defend the Bill of Rights, restrain government, and revitalize personal and economic freedoms in Texas. What distinguished this group was that they were all vociferously anti-Strauss. Strauss shot me a weary look. "The thing that concerns me is the near total loss of influence of the business community, which has allowed really bad ideas like the bathroom bill to fill the void," he said, as we sat down to some delicious crab cakes in the speaker's private dining room. Audubon bird prints adorned the wall. CEOs have stopped coming to the Capitol to engage directly. They now work only through lobbyists, and it's just not the same. Strauss comes from a long-time Republican family in San Antonio. One of his ancestors founded the L. Frank Saddlery Company, which made saddles, harnesses, and whips. Teddy Roosevelt and the Rough Riders stopped in San Antonio to equip themselves with L. Frank gear on their way to the Spanish-American War. The company's slogan was, "The horse, next to woman, God's greatest gift to man." When Strauss is not in Austin, he is an executive in the insurance and investment business. He spent some time as a young man in Washington, where his wife, Julie Brink, worked in the Reagan White House, and in the 1988 George H.W. Bush presidential campaign, while Joe served in the Commerce Department. Texas Monthly called him the last moderating force in Texas politics. Strauss is trim and dapper, like an account executive out of Mad Men. He is certainly the most prominent Jewish politician in Texas history, a fact that has repeatedly been used against him in campaigns to little effect. This is his fifth term as Speaker, which ties a record. He beat Tom Craddock for the post, one of the most dominating speakers the House has ever had. Still, it's a surprise to many observers that the even-tempered Strauss has persevered as long as he has. All the things they said about him, he'd show up at a gunfight with a butter knife, he can't make a fist, they were all wrong, Evan Smith told me. Joe Strauss is so much tougher than he appears. His speakership has concentrated on providing the workforce and infrastructure that Texas businesses need by protecting public education, building roads, establishing more top-tier universities, and expanding job training. Perhaps his biggest victory was passing the state water plan in 2013, when the state was in the middle of a devastating drought. Strauss ushered through a $2 billion revolving loan fund for state water projects. With each session, Strauss has watched the Republican Party drift further away from the compassionate conservatism of the Governor Bush era to domination by social and religious ideologues such as Patrick, for whom economic issues are secondary. Although both Democrats and non-Tea Party Republicans see Strauss as a break on the controversial cultural agenda being pushed by the Lieutenant Governor, Strauss worries that his moderation is being used as a foil for the radicals. I can only do so much to keep the focus on fiscal issues and away from the divisive stuff, he told me. The confidence that people seem to have in the House to serve as a stopper only enables the Senate to run hotter than they ever have before. Strauss believed that most Republicans in the House didn't want to vote on the bathroom bill, but like their colleagues in Washington, they worry about being challenged from the right in the primaries. If it gets to the floor, it could be a close vote, Strauss observed. I can't imagine anyone really wanting to follow North Carolina's example, but I can't guarantee that's not going to happen. Meanwhile, he was pressing his own legislative agenda, which included additional funding for public schools, improving child protective services, and devoting more resources to mental health. All this in a session where the budget had been hit by the decline in oil and gas revenues. Before the session began, Strauss was issuing warnings against the bathroom bill. I've become more blunt than ever, he told me. He frequently urges business leaders to stand up against such legislation. I try to be diplomatic but clear that if you give in on the bathroom bill to preserve a tax break, there's another equally awful idea right behind it. The political story in Texas both reflects and influences the national scene. At a time when Democratic voices have been sidelined, the key struggle is within the Republican Party, between those who primarily align with business interests and those preoccupied with abortion, gay marriage, immigration, religion, and gun rights. The 2017 session in Austin would prove to be a bruising example of raw politics, waged by two talented people, Strauss and Patrick, both of whom fervently believe in their causes. There are crucial differences between Patrick's style of governance and Strauss's, caused by the fact that the lieutenant governor is elected by the voters of the state, whereas the speaker is chosen by House members. Unlike Patrick, who has total control over what bills come to the floor, Strauss exercises influence by artfully appointing committee members who can pull the fangs from the most damaging legislation or let bills languish until there's no time to consider them. Dan Patrick rules by fear, Gene Wu, a Democratic state representative from Houston, told me. Joe Strauss rules by consensus. A few weeks after President Trump was inaugurated, he withdrew the protections that President Obama had instituted for transgender students in public schools. The U.S. Supreme Court now raised the stakes by refusing to hear the case of a transgender student from Virginia, Gavin Grimm, who had sued to be allowed to use the boys' bathroom at school. That left the issue up to individual states, at least for now. Dan Patrick said that the Texas bill would be a model for the rest of the nation. The day after the court's ruling, the Texas bill went to its first public hearing before the Senate Committee on State Affairs. A number of transgender Texans, along with their families, signed up to speak, as did preachers and business leaders and moral crusaders on both sides. More than 400 names were on the list when the hearing finally began. The bill's author, Senator Lois Colkhurst, a Republican from Brenham, said that it was designed to find the balance of privacy, decency, respect, and dignity to protect women, children, and all people. Dana Hodges, the state director of a right-wing Christian organization called Concerned Women for America, was the first to testify. Like many supporters of the bill, she cast the issue as one of women's safety. "I myself was the victim of being videotaped by a hidden camera, placed in a women's bathroom stall by a man," she said in a trembling voice. She held up a plastic coat hook that, she said, had a miniature camera embedded in it, like the one used to spy on her. Under questioning, she acknowledged that a non-transgender man had hidden the camera inside her stall and that he had been punished under existing laws. Colkhurst also conceded that she knew of no crimes that had been committed in Texas bathrooms by transgender persons. Her intent, she said, was to prevent nefarious people from taking advantage of inclusive bathroom policies. Crimes against transgender people, meanwhile, are routine. According to Texas Monthly, a quarter of all transgender Texans have been physically assaulted. Dan Forrest, the lieutenant governor of North Carolina, who had been a muscular advocate of that state's bathroom bill, came to Austin to testify that economic damage was minimal, affecting less than 0.1% of the GDP. He asserted that no business had actually left the state because of the bill. The Associated Press examined public records and interviewed only the business leaders who specifically said that they had canceled projects because of the bill. On the basis of that narrow data alone, the AP estimated that the potential loss on investment in the state would approach $4 billion over a dozen years. On March 30th, the North Carolina legislators, assailed on many fronts, partially repealed their bill. In Austin, most of the witnesses spoke against the bathroom measure. One of them was Dr. Colt Kiehlmeyer, a transgender psychologist who is currently enrolled in the medical school at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston. He wore a white lab coat and a stethoscope around his neck. "If you pass this bill, I will not be able to continue attending medical school because I will not be able to use the men's room," he said. "And look at me. He has a full beard. I certainly would not be able to go into the women's restroom safely." Concerns about voyeurism, he said, were misplaced. "I've used the women's restroom for 23 years and the men's for 10, and I've never seen any genitalia." A woman in a short-sleeved black dress identified herself as Jess Herbst, the mayor of the tiny town of New Hope, north of Dallas, in a firmly Republican section of the state. A few weeks earlier, Mayor Herbst had written a letter to her constituents to tell them that she was taking hormone therapy and transitioning to female. She received what she said was overwhelming support. "It's not our responsibility to keep people from pretending to be us," she said. "I just want to be able to use the women's room and not have someone ask me at the door for my papers." The testimony continued until nearly 5 in the morning, when the committee voted 8-1 to support the bill. After dinner on April 6th, I went down to the Capitol to watch the fight over the budget bill. As you enter the House chamber, you pass through large doors with glass panels etched with the state seal, the garlanded Lone Star, a motif repeated throughout the room, even in the skylights in the coffered ceiling above. During the day, sunlight streams through the slatted shutters on either side of the upstairs gallery. At night, two star-shaped chandeliers illuminate the generous, open room. If you stand under them and look up, you'll see that the lights spell Texas. There's a schoolroom quality to the simple construction of the paired oaken desks where the 150 members sit two by two. Each desk has a small round panel of buttons for casting votes. The accompanying brown leather high-back recliners also have the seal emblazoned on them. When you sit, there's an exhalation as the cushion adjusts. One lawmaker told me that a colleague taped over the vents on the back of the chair in front of him to keep the gust from mussing his hair. In the center of the chamber is a wide aisle with a lectern and microphone at each end, where members present and question bills. The rostrum dominates the back of the chamber. There are three chairs on the platform, one for the speaker in the center, one for the parliamentarian, and another for supplicants that come whisper in the speaker's ear. Directly behind the rostrum is a shrine, two white columns with velvet bunting draped between them, enclosing a silk flag that was carried in the Battle of San Jacinto. It features Lady Liberty holding a cutlass, which is draped with a banner saying, "Liberty or Death." The original battle flag is only displayed while the legislature is in session. At other times, a reproduction takes its place. The room resonates with a sense of history and identity and pride. The air conditioning was merciless. One of the members showed me his long johns poking out from under his shirt cuffs. House members had been at it all day, and once again it would go on till early morning. I saw 5-hour energy shots arrayed on some desk. Desperation suffuses the beautiful chamber on budget night, the last stand for bills that have not been funded. The trick is that in order to get the money for your legislation, you have to take it from somewhere else. The members were on guard lest their own bills be raided. More than 400 amendments to the budget were waiting their turn. One baffling amendment, offered by Valerie Swanson, a freshman Freedom Caucus member from a suburb of Houston, would prevent state funds from being used to renovate bathrooms in order to allow or enable a man to enter a woman's restroom facility. There is a brass rail that circumscribes the chamber. Only members, clerks, and pages can be inside it. Members of the press are supposed to sit at a table near the dais, but I like to hover around the rail, hoping to capture bored legislators. There are some wonderful people in the House. Sinfronia Thompson is a 78-year-old former teacher from Houston. She's a Democrat in her 20th term. Unlike a lot of other state legislatures, Texas still follows a tradition of awarding important posts to members of the minority party. This is true even in Dan Patrick's Senate. Thompson, known as Ms. T, is the chair of the Local and Consent Calendars Committee, one of the gateways that many bills must pass through to reach the floor. She once told me that when she was a girl, African Americans were not welcome in the Capitol. Now she is the longest-serving woman and black person in Texas legislative history. Among her accomplishments is a Hate Crimes Act, passed in 2001, that includes protections for homosexuals. She has also fought against racial profiling and passed measures to help low-income Texans pay their utility bills. Armando Martinez, a 42-year-old Democratic member from the Valley, is a firefighter and a paramedic. He showed up on the first day of the session with a bandage on his head. On New Year's Eve, he had been hit by a stray celebratory bullet. Martinez filed a bill to prohibit the reckless discharge of a firearm. Dr. John Zerwas, an anesthesiologist from Richmond, Texas, is the chair of the House Appropriations Committee. A business conservative Republican in the Strauss mold, he is deeply respected in the legislature, and Strauss selected him to craft the House version of the budget. The main difference between the House budget and the Senate budget is that Zerwas proposed dipping into the rainy day fund, a spare $10 billion amassed from oil and gas taxes that the state has set aside for emergencies. The fund is projected to grow to $12 billion by the next legislative session, which is more than the actual budgets of a dozen other states. Patrick maintains that the fund should not be used for ongoing expenses, but Zerwas proposed taking $2.5 billion out of the pot, in part to finance health care and public schools, Joe Strauss' priorities. There was a telling incident in the afternoon which would provide a glimpse of how the rest of the budget fight would play out. A freshman member, Briscoe Kane, presented an amendment to kill an advisory panel on palliative care. Normally, freshmen keep quiet, but Kane is an assertive member of the Insurgent Freedom Caucus. He is 32 years old, but looks much younger, and bratty, reminding me of Matthew Broderick in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. This amendment seeks to get rid of what I kind of nicknamed the advisory death panel, Kane said, using a term that is popular among the far right for end-of-life counseling. Soon after he said those words, John Zerwas came to the front microphone and stood there, giving Kane what one reporter, Jonathan Tylove of the Austin American-Statesman, termed the morum pellis hispidus distentione nervorum, the hairy eyeball. It's fascinating to watch the choreography of the members when deep political chords are struck. The Freedom Caucus members gathered with Kane at the front of the chamber. The traditional Republicans, along with some Democrats, stood beside Zerwas at the microphone in the rear. It was a Texas version of the Montagues versus the Capulets. "Would you please describe for me what a death panel is?" the mighty chairman of Appropriations demanded. "A death panel is whereby a group of individuals unrelated to the person in the hospital decide whether or not that person will live or die," Kane replied. "Have you ever understood, really, what palliative care is?" said Zerwas. "Mr. Zerwas, being in your profession, I am sure you could inform this body better than I could," Kane replied, looking for help. The old war horses in the house knew, if Kane did not, that Zerwas had lost his first wife to brain cancer. He wore a ring on his right hand in her memory. Zerwas said, "You could probably ask 50, 60, 70, 100 members in this house who have had somebody with a serious illness who has dealt with this particular issue." Zerwas forced Kane several times to admit having made false or uninformed statements. "You know about this and I don't," Kane finally said. "My apologies." The amendment was withdrawn. Kane later got a bit of redemption when he offered an amendment blocking any payment by the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for a sex reassignment or gender transitioning operation, something that has never actually happened. Kane's battle cry, "Don't California, my Texas!" I caught the eye of Pat Fallon, a Republican member from Frisco, a wealthy and intensely conservative bedroom community in the Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex. Many young legislators like Fallon are not originally from Texas. I asked him how he came to the state. He said that after playing football for Notre Dame, he joined the Air Force and was stationed in Texas. When they asked me my state of residence, I said Massachusetts. The payroll officer informed me that Massachusetts has a 5.6% income tax, but there's no income tax in Texas. I said, "I'm a Texan." This was his third term. So far, he's best known for co-authoring a bill in 2013 that reasserted the right of students and employees at public schools to say Merry Christmas rather than Happy Holidays. "Have you got an amendment?" I asked Fallon. "Yes, number 152, in which we defund the portion of the Travis County Public Integrity Unit's investigation of insurance fraud and motor vehicle tax fraud." That unit has been under attack for years because it also addresses crimes committed by state officials. Of course, anything attacking Austin and Travis County is reliably popular in the legislature. Austin is a spore of the California fungus that is destroying America. "Who would do the investigating?" I asked. "We'd give it to the Attorney General," Fallon responded. "But he's under indictment." "I would prefer it not be that way," Fallon admitted, "but he hasn't been convicted." Fallon ranks high on the conservative report cards compiled by watchdog groups by which modern legislators live and die. The most feared is the Fiscal Responsibility Index, a powerful weapon against Republicans who are less than ultra-radical. It is produced by Empower Texas, a group led by Michael Quinn Sullivan, a lobbyist who is known by his initials, MQS, which some members pronounce mucus. Sullivan is tall and friendly. He likes to talk about Boy Scouts. He was an Eagle Scout. The Aggies. He was in the A&M Corps of Cadets. And his three children. He's a right-wing zealot, sometimes described as the most powerful non-elected political figure in Texas. Several years ago, we had lunch, and Sullivan told me, "I'm not there to get a seat at the table. I'm there to get rid of the table." In other words, destroy the government. Empower Texans is largely funded by a reclusive Midland oil man named Tim Dunn, an evangelical Christian who hopes to create in Texas a model of small government that could be replicated by other states and countries. Even people who hate Dunn's politics consider him the most effective money man in the state. His mission has been to push Republican lawmakers to the far right, eliminating the kind of middle ground figures who support Joe Strauss. Dunn has made it a mission to bring the speaker down. While Fallon and I were talking, Jonathan Stickland approached the front microphone. Stickland, a member of the Freedom Caucus, is a former pest control operator from Bedford near Arlington, who now lists himself as an oil and gas consultant. Stickland is heavy-set, with a Falstaffian beard, narrow-set brown eyes, and an occasional broad smile showing beautiful teeth. He made news last session by posting a sign outside his office. Representative Jonathan Stickland, former fetus, District 92. Stickland's amendment was to defund the state's feral hog abatement program, which kills thousands of the rampaging beast every year. Stickland called it a ridiculous waste of money. "It has not worked and it will never work," he cried, infuriating rural lawmakers who consider wild hogs an existential menace. They converged on Stickland from all sides. Everything came to a dead stop. Faces were red. Fists were clenched. While this was going on, Speaker Strauss wandered over to say hello. He seemed totally at ease, smiling, hands in his pockets. He said, "I guess all the hogs are going to move to Arlington," which is partly in Stickland's district. Strauss was in no hurry to impose order. He looked at the scrum of impassioned lawmakers around Stickland, and just think, these are the people responsible for spending $218 billion. At the rear microphone stood Drew Springer Jr., a Republican from North Texas, whose district, twice the size of Maryland, is copiously supplied with wild pigs. He proposed attaching an amendment to Stickland's amendment. It would cut $900,000 in highway funds, the same amount as the hog abatement program, but only in Stickland's hometown. The measure immediately passed with undisguised enthusiasm. Stickland pulled his amendment down, but then he charged toward Springer. They met in the middle of the chamber, nose to nose. Stickland is known to carry a concealed weapon, so I was a little worried. But other members separated the two men, and Strauss reluctantly gaveled the House to order. I left before the budget was finally passed, long after my bedtime. By dawn, it was clear that Dan Patrick and the Tea Party had suffered one defeat after another in Joe Strauss's House. Earlier in the session, Patrick had demanded an up or down vote on subsidizing tuition for private schools, and it was crushed. A proposal to zero out money for the Texas Commission on the Arts was brushed aside. Governor Abbott's Texas Enterprise Fund, which he used to lure businesses to the state, would be emptied, and its budget of $43 million would be divided between child protective services and therapy for disabled children. Ken Paxton, the attorney general, would lose more than $20 million from his budget for lawsuits. That money would be redirected to foster care programs. None of these changes had become law yet. They had to be ratified by the Senate first. At the end of the night, the exhausted Democrats and Republicans made a deal. The Dems would provide only nominal opposition to defunding Planned Parenthood, which was going to happen in any case. In return, the bathroom amendment was dropped. Other controversial amendments were placed in Article 11 of the budget, a kind of wish list of things to be debated one day. They call Article 11 the graveyard. But in the Texas legislature, the dead have been known to walk. Chapter 9. the city of the Violet Crown. When I tell people outside the state that I live in Texas, they often look at me uncomprehendingly. It's like saying that you cheat on your taxes. But if I say I live in Austin, the nearly universal response is, "Oh, Austin is cool." This from people who may have never even been here. For them, living in Austin is forgivable in a way that living in Texas is not. The relationship between the capital and the city of Austin is antagonistic. Austin has long been known as the blue dot on the red state. It sees itself as standing apart from the vulgar political culture of the rest of Texas, like Rome surrounded by the Goths. Republican politicians bridle at the disdain. "It's great to be out of the People's Republic of Austin," Governor Abbott declared recently at a Republican dinner in Bell County. "Once you cross the Travis County line, it starts smelling different. And you know what that fragrance is? Freedom. It's the smell of freedom that does not exist in Austin, Texas." This tirade was apparently triggered by a local ordinance that requires a permit to cut down a tree with a trunk diameter that exceeds 19 inches. When Abbott was attorney general and living in Austin, he was infuriated when he had to compensate the city before cutting down a pecan tree that stood in the way of his future swimming pool. Austin is a city of dogs and bars and food trucks, a pretty city with many quirky passions. At sunset, it is rimmed in refracted light, an atmospheric phenomenon known as the Belt of Venus. William Sidney Porter, a bank teller in Austin before he went to prison for embezzlement and adopted the pen name O. Henry, called Austin the city of the Violet Crown. The hills that serve as a backdrop to the town are covered with junipers that bloom in January, emitting great puffs of red pollen, the source of what is locally called cedar fever. Someone described the citizens of Austin as valedictorians on antihistamines. When Roberta and I moved to Austin in 1980, we were folded into the bird-watching community. It began one day when a neighbor introduced himself. His name was Victor Emmanuel, like the King of Italy. He was slender and bald and strangely limber. He had a habit of crossing his arms behind his back. The neighbor kids were out playing in the front yard with our son, Gordon. Suddenly, Victor froze. "Do you hear that? It's a yellow-billed cuckoo. I bet he's up in a sycamore tree with a caterpillar in his mouth." Sure enough, there was the cuckoo with its dinner, surprised to be noticed. The bird took flight and Victor ran down the street after it, followed by the neighborhood children. Roberta and I looked at each other. It was our first encounter with this particular expression of genius. Victor is known in the tribe of Texas birders as Hooded Warbler, his totemic bird name. The Hooded Warbler is a little yellow bird that darts around nervously, as Victor is known to do. The name was bestowed on him by Edgar Kincaid, Jr., the father of the Texas birding community, a shy, mostly self-taught ornithologist. Although gentle and elaborately civil, Edgar was a misanthrope who hated to see the damage that humanity was inflicting on the natural world. The bird name he awarded himself was cassowary, a flightless bird native to Australia and New Guinea that stands more than 6 feet tall and is sometimes labeled the most dangerous bird in the world. When provoked, it leaps up like Jackie Chan and plunges a 5-inch talon into his adversary. It has been known to disembowel people. Edgar lived by himself across the street from the University of Texas in Austin, in a house that now serves as the office of the Michener Center for Writers. He had a terror of burglars, and instead of sleeping in a bed, he made a nest for himself of sleeping bags and bits of furniture. One night in 1985, someone really did break into his house and rob Edgar at gunpoint. Edgar died of a fever a few days later. In the birding community, people say that cassowary died of fright. Several years before Edgar passed away, I went birding with him and some of the most notable birders in the country, but not including Victor. We were headed down to Eagle Lake, a national wildlife refuge west of Houston. There are more than 600 varieties of bird species in Texas, a greater number than in any other state, thanks to its biological diversity and the fact that it sits in the middle of the central migratory flyway. The goal of this expedition was to see the Ross's goose, which had been spotted among the mass of migratory snow geese that stop over in the rice fields during the winter. We saw pipits and shrikes and sandhill cranes, lots of hawks, and several bald eagles. Among the geese were the Canada goose, the white-fronted goose, and about 4 million of the aptly named snow geese that covered the field in a wintry carpet, but not a single Ross. "How do you tell the difference between a Ross and a snow goose?" I asked in frustration, after staring through my binoculars for an hour at the goose blizzard. "He's a little shorter," one of the birders replied. Edgar added, "and his bill is raspberry-colored as opposed to pink." Those were damn small distinctions. Another year, Roberta and I went with Victor to the same region to see the Atwater's prairie chicken do its mating dance. We went into the blinds built on the grassy prairie around 4 a.m. A century ago, there were about 1 million of them along the Texas and Louisiana Gulf Coast, but the combination of grazing, drought, predators, and urbanization has reduced the wild population to fewer than 100 individuals. Just before 6 a.m., I heard a hollow, ghostly sound, like someone blowing in a large bottle. It was the booming of the males. In the dimmest light of dawn, I began to discern their movement, ritually challenging one another as they staked out their territory. The rim of the sun appeared on the horizon, inflaming the colors of these splendid birds. The bodies of the males were the shade of brown sugar, with black stripes, the feathers turning maroon at the base of the throat. Bright golden air sacs on the neck ballooned as the males called, and their neck tufts stood up like antlers. Then the chickens began to dance. One of the males stomped the earth, and the other males, there were 9 of them, followed along in a kind of jig. Then 2 males charged each other, stumpy tails erect, fluttering into the air and nearly colliding, then retreating to their imagined property lines, staring each other down, beak to beak. During all this commotion, the females, such doughty little critters to be the object of so much brilliant aggression, strolled by with a studied nonchalance. After 8, with the sun fully up, the birds dispersed, and we emerged from the blind, dazed by the primitive magic of the performance. We had come to see every tuft of grass, every clod of dirt, as a vital landmark, invested with almost biblical significance. But in the full light of day, it was difficult to even locate those signposts. We spent the rest of the morning spotting eagles and shorebirds and caracaras, the low-flying black-and-white falcons you sometimes see in South Texas. As we passed the mass of snow geese, Victor casually noted, "Oh, look, y'all, a Ross's goose." "Where?" He pointed in the direction of about 500 birds near a tree line 100 yards away. "How can you tell?" "He's a little shorter," Victor said, "and his bill is raspberry-colored as opposed to pink." "There's another one." To my astonishment, Austin is now the second most popular tourist destination in the country, behind Las Vegas. One can already sniff the artifice and inauthenticity that transform previously charming environments into amusement parks for conventioneers. The very places that made Austin so hip are being demolished to make room for the hotels and office spaces needed to accommodate the flood of tourists and newcomers who have come to enjoy what no longer exists. Forbes magazine just determined that Austin is the best place to live in America, which will only take it further from the manageable town it was to the megacity it is destined to become. Another indication of Austin's growing international reputation is that Kim Jong-un placed the city on North Korea's nuclear strike list right after New York, Washington, D.C., and Los Angeles. My band has a regular gig at a fabulous dive in East Austin called the Skylark Lounge, which is tucked away behind an auto body shop and not even visible from the street. If you sneeze, the whole place might turn a somersault. Recently, Yelp labeled it the best music venue in the nation, heralding its inevitable demise by the developers, if Kim Jong-un doesn't get it first. Austin is divided north and south by the Colorado River, which is dammed to make Lady Bird Lake. The riverbanks are lined with towering cypress trees, which fill up with cormorants and egrets in the winter months. There's a rusty train trestle spanning the water, covered with oddball graffiti, such as, "I've got ninja-style kung fu grip." I always feel an aesthetic release when the Southern Pacific freight train rumbles overhead while the rowing crews, like racing centipedes, pass underneath and runners circle the path, a pleasing convergence of opposing motions. I'm reminded of Thomas Eakin's paintings of the oarsmen of the Schuylkill River in Philadelphia, with the clouds mirrored in the rippled water like rumpled sheets. Like the Seine in Paris, the Colorado serves as a cultural divide. On the north bank are downtown, the state capital, and the University of Texas, anchors of a city historically made up of teachers and bureaucrats. The south bank has Tex-Mex restaurants and dance halls. Austin is on the tail end of the dance belt, which starts in Louisiana with New Orleans R&B, runs through Cajun Zydeco, enters Conjunto territory in South Texas, and then encounters the Czech waltzes and German polkas of Central Texas. The medium that the dance music travels through is Catholicism. In North Texas, the Southern Baptists and the Church of Christ hold sway. There's an old joke that the reason Baptists won't screw standing up is that somebody might think they were dancing. When we arrived in Austin in 1980, there were drug dealers and prostitutes along South Congress Avenue. The women stationed themselves in front of the seed and feed store, where you could still buy dyed baby chicks for Easter. That's all been cleaned up now, but there's still a defiant residual funkiness that is pretty much all that remains of the city's unofficial slogan, "Keep Austin Weird." We bought a duplex on the south side in a neighborhood called Travis Heights. Most of the houses on the street, except one, were modest one-story affairs, although there was also a handsome brick semi-mansion belonging to William Broyles Jr., the editor of Texas Monthly, and my boss at the time, who would later become a notable screenwriter. Molly Ivins lived several blocks away. Despite the celebrity of some of our neighbors, there was an appealing absence of pretense, which was part of the charm of South Austin. The motto of our side of town, Molly once wrote, should be, "South Austin, a great place to buy auto parts." Our next-door neighbor sold appliances, and next to him was Terrence Malick, the filmmaker, who occasionally walked our kids to school. East and West Austin are divided by I-35, sometimes referred to as the interracial highway. As black and Hispanic families have been pushed out of the east side through gentrification, Austin has become one of the most economically segregated cities in the country. The lack of affordable housing has taken an awful toll on the diversity that made the city so democratic in its youth. Austin currently has one of the highest rates of startup companies of any metro area in the country. From watching Austin transform itself into the city it is now, I've developed a very Texas theory of how cultures evolve. Mike Levy began Texas Monthly in 1973, and it became the seedbed for the literary community. Bill Whitliff, the screenwriter for the epic television series Lonesome Dove and a number of successful movies, decided not to move to Hollywood, and his intransigence made it plausible for filmmakers to stay in Austin. Now Richard Linklater, Robert Rodriguez, and many others have turned the city into a film capital of international stature. In the fall of 1980, John Mackey started the first certified organic grocery store in the United States. It was not much larger than a 7-Eleven. On Memorial Day, 1981, we had the worst flood in 70 years, and the store was practically destroyed. Mackey had no insurance, but neighbors and customers helped clean it up and restock the shelves, courtesy of kind-hearted creditors and vendors. By 2005, it had become a Fortune 500 company called Whole Foods. In 1983, Michael Dell, a freshman pre-med student at the University of Texas, started assembling computers in his dorm room. The following year, he incorporated the Dell Computer Corporation, capitalizing the venture with $1,000. What started as three guys with screwdrivers now employs 138,000 people. There are more than 5,000 high-tech companies in Austin, and they all hark back to that freshman in room 2713 of the Dobie Center dormitory. In each of these examples, a single individual with a unique vision started a company that became a hub for similar enterprises, and in the process, transformed the culture. These are stories Texans like to tell about themselves, how imaginative entrepreneurs, not government, conjure up entire industries and create opportunity in the form of good jobs and enlightened communities. Something similar is happening now in the city with the video game industry and national intelligence. There are so many ex-spooks moving to Austin, it has become a kind of Texas Abbottabad. The evolution of the Austin music scene is more organic and harder to explain. On the east side, there was Victory Grill, part of the Southern Chitlin circuit, where Billie Holiday and Big Mama Thornton would perform. In the early 1950s, Bobby Bluebland, then a soldier stationed at Fort Hood, would drive down to sing on amateur night. Rock and roll arrived, bringing Chuck Berry and James Brown and Ike and Tina Turner. On the south side of town was the headquarters for country music, the Broken Spoke, where Roy Acuff, Ernest Tubb, and Tex Ritter would play. There was a gas station on the north side owned by Kenneth Threadgill, a country yodeler who also secured the first license to sell beer in Travis County. In the 1960s, he began inviting hippies and folk singers to join his Wednesday night sing-alongs. Janis Joplin would sing duets with him while she was studying art at the university. Clifford Antone, son of Lebanese immigrants in East Texas, came to UT in 1968, but he dropped out after his first arrest for smuggling pot. The blues club he started, Antone's, became an institution in the music world. The musicians he mentored, including Stevie Ray Vaughan and Gary Clark Jr., would rejuvenate the blues form, creating a distinctive Austin sound. Then in 1970, a local band manager named Eddie Wilson was looking for a venue in South Austin and stumbled across a decrepit National Guard armory. He transformed it into the Armadillo World Headquarters, a strange amalgamation of psychedelic country hippie and rock and roll. There were only 250,000 people in Austin then, but 50,000 of them were students. Musicians began moving to town as if some homing device were summoning them all at once. Jerry Jeff Walker came from New York, Guy Clark from Houston, Jimmy and Stevie Ray Vaughan from Dallas. Marsha Ball was on her way from Baton Rouge to San Francisco when her Austin Healey Sprite broke down in Austin, and she never went farther. Austin already had a flourishing musical subculture, in other words, even before Willie Nelson played the Armadillo in August 1972. All of these disparate cultural trends that were careening past each other in Austin like swirling electrons suddenly coalesced into a recognizable scene when Willie arrived. He occupies a place in Texas, and especially in Austin, that no one else can claim. He was a jazz-infused country singer with a gospel background and a songwriter with some notable hits. When his house in Nashville burned down, he decided to return to his home state, hoping to find more creative freedom. He let his beard grow and put his hair in pigtails. You never saw a man looking like that in Texas, but Willie could get away with it. Because he is so culturally confounding and because his songs are so much a part of the land, everybody claims Willie. He's a leftist, a Bernie Sanders fan, but he's beloved even by Tea Party types like Ted Cruz and Rick Perry. For decades, he has advocated legalization of marijuana in a state where the laws of possession are quite punitive. He has even been cultivating his own brand, Willie's Reserve. Every once in a while, some state trooper or deputy sheriff will pull Willie's bus over and discover his stash. Willie has gotten off with a free concert, but the arrests are universally seen as poor sportsmanship. In 2016, I went to Willie's annual 4th of July picnic. Mickey Raphael, Willie's harmonica player, invited me on the bus. There were actually three of them in Willie's entourage. This one was weed-free. As Willie has gotten older and even more physically diminished, there's an existential quality to his performances. Nearly all of his contemporaries are gone. During performances, Willie stands alone in front, with Mickey a couple steps behind his left shoulder, providing a kind of harmonic commentary. It's a conversation that has been going on a long time. "This is my 43rd picnic," Mickey told me. As he was showing me around the bus, Mickey pulled back the drape on his closet. "You'll want to see this," he said, pulling out a gray guitar case. Inside was Trigger, the acoustic guitar that Willie named after Roy Rogers' beautiful horse. It is perhaps the most famous musical instrument in America, rivaled only by Lucille, B.B. King's Black Gibson, although there have been many Lucilles and only one Trigger. "Here," Mickey said, handing it to me. Trigger is really light. It has a big hole near the bridge, worn through by Willie's pinky and ring fingers. Pick marks have scored the face, paper thin. The entire instrument feels sheer, the frets worn down to nearly nothing. It's been signed many times. Leon Russell used a pocket knife. But the signatures are fading into the patina. If you saw this guitar at a garage sale, you would walk on by. And yet, Trigger has somehow maintained his distinctive, mellow voice, a sound Willie thought resembled that of his hero, Django Reinhardt. Although, to me, it sounds like Willie himself, twangy and full of character. I'm in a group that puts up statues in Austin, and our most recent work was a bronze Willie holding Trigger that now graces the entry to the Austin City Limits studio. I got to pose for that statue holding a Martin guitar of the same model, N20. Cleet Shields of Philadelphia was our sculptor. In 2011, when the statue was cast and delivered to Austin, we covered it with a parachute and stored it in a movie studio until it could be installed. One night, Willie came by for a private unveiling. He was gracious but a little overwhelmed as he exchanged a long look with himself. Bill Whitliff, who is on our committee, explained that what we liked about this piece was its engagement with the audience. "People will come to you," he said. "Little children will touch your knee and seek your counsel." "Do what I say and not what I do," Willie advised. We kept the statue in the studio for months, but we couldn't seem to get Willie to agree on a date for the public unveiling. He was being modest or embarrassed or coy. We couldn't decide which. Finally, he allowed that he might be free on April 20th, 2012. The date didn't mean anything to me, but Marcia Ball, another member of our committee, guffawed. 4/20, she said. "You know what that is. It's National Marijuana Day." So we unveiled the statue at 4:20 p.m. on April 20th. Willie stood in front of his giant likeness and sang, "Roll me up and smoke me when I die." We now live in a neighborhood called Tarrytown. Steve's house is just around the corner. We're in a forest of cedar elms, so it's shadier than most parts of town, always a consideration in Texas. When we first looked at the house, which is two stories and faced in yellow brick, it was late winter, and the robins were churning through the berry bushes on the back fence, getting a little drunk. There was a lot of work to be done, but the house was sturdy, and I was sure I could feel at home here. I persuaded the bank I could afford the mortgage. I had sold a movie that Oliver Stone was going to direct. He had already cast Al Pacino in the lead role. A week after we closed on the house, Oliver called me. "Larry, I had a bad dream last night," he said in his satanic whisper. "No movie." I never learned exactly what happened, but I now owned a house way beyond my means. One lesson Hollywood teaches you is this: don't buy the house until you've eaten the popcorn. Still, I was trapped in one of those periodic episodes of lusting after wealth and fame. When the lady across the street moved to New York, her house stayed vacant for 3 months, with a for rent sign in front. One day, Roberta asked a neighbor to help jumpstart our car. She had noticed that the rent sign was down, so she asked our neighbor if the house had been rented. "Yeah," he said, "to a movie star." "Really, who?" "I think his name is Mark McDonald or something like that. They say he's real handsome." Roberta thought for a moment, then guessed, Matthew McConaughey? That's the one. She had seen some guy drive up in a big white van wearing a cut-off sweatshirt. She almost took offense at the cheeky look he cast in her direction. Soon we began seeing him out in the yard landscaping, usually with his shirt off, which attracted the attention of just about everybody. This was a few years before People magazine named him the sexiest man alive. The house is a little gray one-story bungalow, the kind